Okay, so the next class is one of the ones where it actually has a fun title, because I was just in that kind of mood when I came up with this. Yes. If you went to more of my classes, Carrie, you'd know they're all dismal and horrible.
I've been to one of your classes. I like the Markovo one.
I know. Oh, yeah, that's true. That was a good one. About, like, God's going to destroy me for talking about this.
You didn't get targeted very much.
Not very much. Not until the last class where my... No, it was the first one where my room flooded, wasn't it?
No, it was the second one, I think.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure you got smited after the first one.
Yeah. No, it was the last one. Because I came home and I was like, oh my God, I have to go teach and my computer's covered in water.
Yeah,
but
I didn't want you to get smited because then Chris would probably make me do something. That would suck.
But you get all the future Lodge Master jokes.
Oh.
But so yesterday my friend was laughing about how I get too touristy when we go places. And I was like, yeah, but all of my touristy desires are really, like, dismal, depressing touristy desires. Because it was, like, 2 in the morning when we got to Atlantic City. And I was like, I want to see how dead the boardwalk is at 2 in the morning when it's raining in the autumn. Let's go out and walk around the boardwalk. Yeah, and he was like, why would you want to go look at that?
Can I Bogart your Snuggie?
Yeah. The Snuggie?
Yes.
It is.
I have no idea why you're not cold, but if you get cold, I will give you this.
Well, I also enjoy being cold.
Huh?
I also enjoy being cold.
Okay. If you insist, that's cool.
We could just snuggle up on the sofa and make Chris move.
Well, those are the best classes where everyone starts cuddling, because cuddling always leads to...
Okay.
You do it right anyway.
Is that what that is?
Yes.
Yes, it's a
rehearsal.
They are the most ridiculous creation ever. I couldn't figure out how to put it on when I first got it. Like, I kept trying to put it on like a robe, and I was like,
this is
so uncomfortable. I think we just need to order a bunch of Snuggies and have meetings in Snuggies. There's a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Snuggie now. Like, I can't remember if they sell it at Spencer's or Hot Topic. Like,
you know they make Snuggies for dogs, too.
Oh, wow.
There's... Well, Walmart sells camo Snuggies.
Of course it does.
They sell guns, too.
Yes. So... This class is the rosy way. It ain't all rose-colored glasses, but it's as good as gold. It's our Rosicrucian class. So, to start off, of course, because everything always starts off with a question. The question...
Hey, guys, he's starting.
Yes.
Thank you.
So, thank you. The question to start off with this, obviously, is what is Rosicrucianism? Because there's a whole bunch of different ideas on what it is. Like Mo mentioned and Ron mentioned, both of them have had Amwork involvement. So Amwork was in your list, right? You've been in everything. But So the impression you would get of what Rosicrucianism is from Amwork is pretty different from what you'd get if you joined one of the other Rosicrucian organizations, or if you hung out with John Dee's kid back when Rosicrucianism was getting started. Assuming that the myths about him starting it are true. But there's all sorts of different approaches to it. And if you look at historical Rosicrucianism, one of the analyses of that is that it was essentially a growth out of the Protestant Reformation, that it was a Protestant kickback at Catholicism, kind of saying, like, hey, we're Protestants, but we can still have mysticism too. And our mysticism is going to be based on the fact that we're Protestants and that we hate you Catholics. And we're going to learn to be better magicians so Protestantism can win. The image of Rosicrucianism is a much nicer one than that. If you look at the early stories of the Rosicrucian Brotherhood, you had seven members who learned magic and spiritual truths from Christian Rosenkreutz. And after he went to Demkar out in the Middle East and learned secrets from the magicians there that were not known by the European magicians. And he came back and tried to teach the European magicians, but most of them wouldn't accept that he knew the secrets that they didn't know. And so he gathered his small group of students, and each one of them taught another student, so that there would always be these seven Rosicrucians who would go out and do the Rosicrucian work. And the Rosicrucian work, like we mentioned earlier, was based on the idea of providing healing to the sick and helping those in need through your magical capabilities. And they expressly would not take money for this. It was like sort of the first magical movement that had this component of like, no, we can't take money for our magical stuff that we do.
I can totally take money for my magic.
You want your palm crossed with silver?
Oh, fuck
yes.
That's an interesting sentence.
What the hell did you summon in there?
It's not that. Then you had the development of Masonic Rosicrucianism. Rosicrucianism was like a huge boom. It was like the philosophical version of a bubble. And basically you had people in Europe going crazy trying to get Rosicrucian texts and write new Rosicrucian texts and being able to claim that they were part of the Rosicrucians or they knew Rosicrucians or were somehow connected to this. And the idea took such an intense hold that other secret societies wanted their societies to be Rosicrucian also. And so you have all the Masonic Rosicrucianism developing, where within different Masonic orders you would have a handful of degrees that were related to Rosicrucianism, and where you became a Rosicrucian by taking these Masonic degrees. So you didn't even have to go join another organization. You were just, well, our organization is so awesome, it contains this other organization and its mysteries. Which, of course, none of us in the OTO ever have been part of an organization that says that it contains all these other organizations because it's so much better and more awesome. Because it's up through the Victorian era, that was just how magical organizations work. Yes, it's just like, oh, well, when you join our organization, technically you now are part of all of these other things because we absorbed all of them.
That's the
board. Yes. So with the Masonic Rosicrucianism, they worked in essentially Masonic mysteries reworked into Rosicrucian language and kind of collected them together in different Masonic traditions as different sets of degrees. And they kind of became the main organization that continued the popularity and the expression of a Rosicrucian movement. But even with that, part of the allure of Rosicrucianism was the overall myth that it represented. Not simply this idea of like, okay, you've got these seven mystics who are like the best magicians in the world and they go around freely helping other people. But it grew into this idea that 111 years after the death of Christian Rosenkreutz, Rosicrucianism was able to be revealed to the world. And so that's why the Rosicrucian manifestos were written. And it was revealed to the world because it was now able to expand beyond those seven people and be this big movement. And it was revealed that Rosicrucianism was the Great White Brotherhood, which was the mysterious secret organization behind all of the Western mystery tradition and all of the world's religions. And so people wanted to be a part of that and say, like, oh, well, we're the biggest badasses on the block because we're part of the most secret organization that's ever existed and we run everything. And even the church is really controlled by us and was started by us, and Jesus and Buddha and Muhammad and all of them, they were really part of our group, and they were just doing things that the Great White Brotherhood told them to do by starting their religions.
You're saying that Dan Brown is their writer.
Yes. He went back in time after H.G. Wells brought him the time machine, and then he went back and created Rosicrucianism. Now, the basic symbol of Rosicrucianism is really the key to the whole philosophy and the whole purpose of what Rosicrucianism is. And it is a golden cross surmounted by a red rose. The confraternity of the Rose Cross makes a big deal about how anyone that says the Rosy Cross is clearly not a Rosicrucian because they're imagining a pink cross. I've never actually seen anyone say Rosy Cross and mean that, but the whole idea is that you've got this cross and this rose, and they're together, and that's what symbolizes this order. So what you have in this symbol is this very kind of alchemical thing. You have a golden cross. And so gold is one of the perfect materials, essentially, or one of the closest materials to being perfect. Really, the Philosopher's Stone is the only actual perfect material. But gold is resistant to fire and decay, and so it can't be purified more than it already is. It represents the sun, and so it represents the soul. And it's the idea of things that are refined. When you take another base metal in alchemy and you apply the Philosopher's Stone to it, the Philosopher's Stone is supposed to make that metal into gold, because gold represents perfection within the mineral kingdom. And each kingdom actually has its own form of perfection. That's why grapes are used, and wine is used so much in alchemy, because the grape is perfection within the plant kingdom. So you have this idea of a cross that's made of the closest material to being refined and perfect. And the cross is elemental. It's a four-armed cross, and so you have the elements intersecting with each other and being held in a stable and balanced position made of this gold, which is representing perfection. So you have a perfect union of the elemental structure within the cross. The cross is then surmounted by a rose. And the rose is the revelation of the essence through the purified substance. So the rose is essentially the soul. You could think of it as being similar to a crucifix, in which Christ represents man being perfected by living as a manifestation of the soul, and so he is the soul, if you're taking it in a Gnostic sense, of the bodiless Christ, and that soul is placed upon the cross. Now, in that symbol, the soul is there because it's a sacrifice in order to perfect the world. In this symbol, the elemental structure is already perfected. It's made of gold. So you're not sacrificing the rose. The rose is being revealed by this state of perfecting the elements and having them work together in tandem in this perfect fashion. It's not quite surmounting in the same sense of the pentagram, in which you have the spirit crowning matter, and matter flows out from the spirit, but the movements of the spirit are also what's controlling and organizing matter. In the rose cross symbol, it's much more naturalistic. And that's why it's a rose, because it's something which grows and blossoms and comes forth and shows beauty in doing so. And it's something that is multifaceted through all the petals, and you can peel back the layers on it and explore deeper and deeper mysteries through the rose. So the rose really is representing the naturalistic nature of the essence freed through the perfection of the substance. And that's really the point of alchemy. In alchemy, you purify a substance, and you purify your soul by reflecting upon the process of purification that the substance is undergoing, so that in a spiritual sense, you are undergoing the same process that the material that you're working on is undergoing. And when you take that concept, what you're saying is that by going through this process of perfecting matter, perfecting nature, you're revealing the truth of your nature in doing so in this exploration. The actual beauty of the essence that is you is now no longer hidden, because you've destroyed all of the impure things that would have been hiding it to begin with. Basically, it's like if you took a big hunk of shit from out in the street and you burned away all of the dung off of that and found this golden cross within there. and then you rejoice at the perfection of this golden cross, and that rejoicing is the flowering and blossoming of the soul forth from the material there. That's a very crude comparison. Not crude in the sense that you're
putting
shit, but
that.
Yes. Another way you can kind of look at the symbol is that on some level it relates to the symbol of Venus. The symbol of Venus has a cross which has a circle over top of it. The cross in that symbol is the balanced structure of the elements. The circle is the sun. So you have the sun ruling over and overpowering the elemental reality in Venus, which is why Venus is copper, because it's a metal that has an overabundance of celerity, and that's why you can kind of bend it and break it down and melt it easily. In this case, you're not dealing with that because that's still an imbalance. You're dealing with a more perfected form of this concept. And so you're dealing with a much more solar symbol. One of the kind of secrets of alchemy is that you have Venus, and if you go across Venus on the Tree of Life, you have Mars. And so you have copper and iron. And their symbols are the reverse of each other. Traditionally, the symbol of iron, or the symbol of Mars, is a circle surmounted by a cross. So you have the elements overtaking the sun. So the spirit is hidden within the depths of matter. And in Venus, you have the spirit, or the soul, overtaking matter. And you can combine them together through the two central crosses so that you have this kind of balanced dissolution of the two elemental states, with the two solar forces balancing in on each other so that they're then drawn together into the middle. And you have the soul and the elements in a perfected state in which the elements express the soul and the soul guides the elements, but neither one imbalances or obscures the other. And that is the symbol of the Rose Cross, at least as it's depicted by the Golden Dawn, in which you have the cross with the circle around the center representing the rose. And if you go in between Venus and Mars, you have the sun in Tiferet. And so the combination of copper and iron, or the overabundance of celerity and the overabundance of the elements, allows for a balanced state, which is the state of the Rose Cross. So by perfecting the two crosses through each other, you're allowing the blossoming of the sun, or the shining of the gold, which is represented by the rose. The other element of that... Oh, yes. In actual physical alchemy, Isaac Newton writes about the creation of the net, which is a metal material. It's an alloy that's used in one of the final steps of creating the Philosopher's Stone, at least according to Newton. And the net is created by combining copper and iron together into an alloy, which is actually very hard to do because their melting temperatures are so different. But there are actual scientists now who are working with Newton's alchemical journals who have created this net material and have found that it matches up with the descriptions of how Newton says it's supposed to look and what its properties are supposed to be. Now, whether or not they can create the Philosopher's Stone from it, who knows? They're probably not going to actually try, but they were able to actually create that. So that sort of symbolism of relating to Venus and the combination of Venus and iron is one that actually proves out in the Mineral Kingdom. So we've got this basic idea of Rosicrucianism, is that you have this idea of balancing out the elements and perfecting and refining the elemental substance through the application of alchemy so that the soul can be revealed and you can understand the truth of and beauty of your inner nature at that point, that you realize that this gross material that you're dealing with allows the expression of the actual spiritual material once it's in a more perfected and ready state. So you could just drop everything else and say, all right, well, we kind of all are Rosicrucians in some sense then, that that's what we're trying to do, that we want to perfect our material selves, and not necessarily your body, but the way in which you live and interact in the physical world, so that you can come to understand your soul and have that kind of shine forth through what you're doing in a way that's going to lead you to happiness and success. the point of having the rest of Rosicrucianism is to show you how to get there. And so you have Rosicrucianism, as we kind of got into the occult revival, remained popular the way that it had when it first sprung up. And so there were lots of different forms of Rosicrucianism. And again, the first one most people are going to think of is Amwork. But Amwork has very little to do with what we're actually talking about with Rosicrucianism. And so I'm going to throw Amwork under the bus a little bit before we go into the other things. But it really is an anomaly of the Rosicrucian tradition. It's not at all like most of the rest of it. Granted, Willie Schroeder's Rosicrucian notebook describes a very Amwork-like Rosicrucianism. And they do express a lot of the mythology that grew up around Rosicrucianism, surrounding like the weird esoteric sciences of it. But they don't actually stem from a Rosicrucian order. Well, they don't stem from a straight-up Rosicrucian order. They stem from a charter that was given them by the OTO in order to have an organization out in California in the United States. And they kind of broke away from their OTO connections because Royce made it obvious that Crowley was going to be a successor, and Spencer Lewis didn't like Crowley and didn't want anything to do with him or with Thelema. And so he's like, well, we're going to go play in another sandbox, and we're not going to acknowledge that he come from the OTO.
There are no mysticists who behave like that now,
yes.
Ever.
Like just about every other mystical group that, as Stephanie has pointed out, they do have a couple splinter groups. Confraternity of the Rose Cross is probably the biggest one. These they have had their own little we want to go play in another sandbox things. But they definitely have the branding power. They, when people say Rosicrucian to someone in the occult community, people are going to think of Amwork. And even outside of the occult community, if someone has an idea of what Rosicrucians are, they're probably thinking Amwork.
Amwork was very big. When I joined back in the 70s, they were like 35,000 just in the U.S.
I was going to say, like, I know at one point they were like the huge organization for the New Age movement, essentially. Yeah, they...
In the backs of comic books and magazines.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Expensive for like small little things that they send you once a month.
Yeah,
that's why real material.
And
that was actually how the Golden Dawn survived, though. Moena Mathers converted it to a mail order organization. Yes. Yes. Aside from Amwork, you have the continuations of the Masonic Rosicrucian offsets. So the big important one for us is the SRIA, or the Societas Rosicruciana in Anglia, which also has two American branches, Societas Rosicruciana in Americana, and Societas Rosicruciana in Civitatis Federoibus. One of the American ones is purely for Masons. The other one is open to other people. Both of them are still in operation. I'm not sure whether or not SRIA in England is still in operation. But what they did was they actually created something along Rosicrucian lines stemming from the Masonic Rosicrucian system, where they actually were like, well, we're going to practice what we think is Rosicrucian magic. And they came up with a whole grade structure related to this, where their initial four initiations were all based on alchemical symbolism and the idea of, instead of discovering Christian Rosenkreuz's tomb, that you discover an alchemist in a lab. And they go through like the process of the unfoldment of understanding what's happening in this alchemical laboratory. And they were a big influence in the development of the Golden Dawn.
And what was that name again? It's not SRIA.
It is SRIA, Societas Rosicruciana in Anglia. So just the Latin for Rosicrucian Society in England.
Okay, so there were
And then,
so
oh, the...
Just one, not two.
The, oh, yes, there is another SRIA, which is the same thing, except it's Americana instead of Anglia. And then in the United States, then there's SRICF, Societas Rosicruciana Inquietatis Federoibus.
Inquietatis?
Federoibus, so in the federal
US.
States, yeah.
Yes.
Everybody needs an alias.
So they were a major influence on the Golden Dawn because the three founders of the Golden Dawn were all members of SRIA. And Wynne Westcott was, I believe, at one point the like magus of SRIA, so like their like head guy. And the Golden Dawn picked up their grade structure from the SRIA. So they used a 10-grade Kabbalistic structure just like the SRIA did, and which I think there's some hinting at that the German Golden Dawn Order probably did the same thing, and there were a few other continental Rosicrucian groups that used Kabbalistic grade structures at the time. And that seems to be one of the hallmarks of what's passed along in these Rosicrucian systems, is that you use a Kabbalistic grade structure and that they're working not only with magic, but specifically with alchemy. And for our purposes, the grade structure is the major hallmark that we're going to look at. That in looking at whether or not an organization is Rosicrucian, it has alchemical components, it's about perfecting the self in order to obtain union with the soul, and it uses the Kabbalah as its model for how it initiates you through its grades. Now, within the Golden Dawn and to some degree the SRIA, and as far as we can tell, some of the other like European Rosicrucian groups, because there's a lot of debate about how those worked, since there wasn't a clean continuation of any of them, and a lot of them got subsumed into other more popular continental groups, and then what was left kind of got picked up by the Golden Dawn. The series of 10 grades is broken up into 3 degrees. And the SRIA did that and continued that Rosicrucian method. The Golden Dawn used and clarified the system very cleanly. And then the AA took on the same system and simplified it and kind of focused the 3 degrees more as to a little bit of what the how they worked as far as like the hallmarks of the major initiation, whereas the grades were just kind of teaching you the things to move you along to that point of degree initiation.
3 degrees, are you like talking like in the Golden Dawn system, you have 3 orders?
Yes, the orders and the degrees are the same thing.
Okay.
So in the Golden Dawn, you have the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, you have the RR at AC, or the Ruby Rose and Cross of Gold, and you have the Order of the SS, or the Silver Star. In the AA, you have the Order of the GD, the Order of the RC, and the Order of the SS. Basically the same thing. And you do get the terminology for the abbreviations used, but within the AA system, specifically, like in the Golden Dawn system, the abbreviations straight up mean the words. In the AA system, the abbreviations can use the words as a shorthand for the abbreviations, but they're actual references to other things that Order of the GD, Order of the RC, and Order of the SS mean in terms of visionary experiences that you go through with those degrees. So as far as the system itself, you've got your 3 degrees. You have the Hermit, the Lovers, and the Man of Earth, as expressed in Liberal, or the Book of the Law. And these are your 3 primary points of initiation. You can basically go through any initiatory process that you want, and it doesn't matter how their grade structure is set up or what you're doing in those grades. If you're going through the main hallmarks of initiation through the mysteries, then you're still going to hit those 3 degrees and the mysteries that those 3 degrees relate to, if you complete the process of initiation. And Crowley even notes that in the AA materials, in Libra Grata Montis Abegni. where it talks about some of the requirements for the initial elemental grades of the AA. He basically wraps up with, you don't have to do any of this. You just have to become an adept. And so, like, it basically explains that there are all kinds of different ways that you can get to that point, but you still have to go through that point of initiation where you're entering into the degree that's described as the lovers in the Book of the Law. So to go through the degrees first, you've got the Man of Earth, or the Magician. All of these are tarot cards. And so that relates to Nuit, or the concept of the divine feminine, or the kind of unrefined cosmos. Wait, what? And the sort of the universal principle where you have everything in an unmanifest, undivided fashion. So you're dealing with the spirit in alchemy, or the not the essence of the thing, but the substance from which everything is made. And so there is no essence in anything at this point. All you have is substance. And within that substance, as you start to develop a breakdown of it, you're going to understand the substance through the elements. The elements being given kind of overarching states that the substance can appear within or manifest itself in. Basically, the idea that matter moves through a handful of phases or conditions in which you have the same matter, but it's experienced in a different way based on the conditions in which it's manifesting. You have two hallmark visions that are undergone in this phase. The vision of the machinery of the universe and the vision of the Golden Dawn. Now,
first one again, the vision of the
machinery of the universe and the vision of the Golden Dawn. Now, to get into what actually is undergone or seen in those would be silly, because you have to undergo them yourself. But with the vision of the machinery of the universe, the basic idea is that you are understanding kind of almost like the clockwork function of the universe, that the way in which all the parts work together in order to create all the different things that you're going to experience, and the way in which all these things have an interconnectivity to them despite their separation. With the vision of the Golden Dawn, it relates more to kind of understanding the sort of nature of the light and the glory of God and of the soul, and how that is reflected through your work. The overall point of the process through that degree is the refinement of the material self through spiritual alchemy. So material here goes back to that concept of the cosmos or the spirit, where you have the kind of undefined material from which everything is made. It's not simply refining your body. Like, it's not saying that the first order of initiation involves going out and doing jumping jacks and running marathons, although it can. And Clint would probably hit me if I said it didn't. But that all of those things which relate to your being within the physical sphere of Earth, the way in which you interact with the people around you, the way in which you interact with all of your possessions and with the things that you do in your day-to-day life, that you're refining all of that while refining your body and your actual physical self, so that you are preparing essentially to become a perfected vessel for your soul. So you have this idea that you are this gross, unrefined material. And by undergoing these processes, you understand the material that you are better, you understand the universe around the material better, and you purify and destroy all the things that are not actually part of you. And that in having the perfected material version of yourself, you are then able to understand and become a vessel for the perfected spiritual version of yourself. And so at that point, the soul or essence is able to enter into the substance and give it true form and direction. And this is done through focus and discipline. In the AA system, you're pretty much entirely just dealing with focus and discipline through that point because you're doing Crowley's version of yoga and going out and memorizing texts and sitting in asanas and controlling your breath and doing all kinds of different yogic meditations in order to perfect your ability to control your mind and to control your body and to make the two work together. And then you have a few magic things that are thrown in there along the way. In the Golden Dawn system, as we discussed, you're using education as the focus and discipline. So you're going through and learning all the different parts of magic and magical practice and disciplining yourself through the various meditations that they give you in order to integrate that knowledge so that you're taking this discipline that you're learning and you're using that to kind of guide and hone yourself in to where you have this control and focus that's needed in order to perfect yourself. The idea here of having this perfected vessel is one that is expressed multiple times in different metaphysical and spiritual systems. And I think one of the clearest ones is in the Lurianic Kabbalah, where it talks about the creation of the universe. And God creates the tree of life, and he puts all these clay vessels on the tree. And then the kind of pre-manifest version of God, the Adam Kadmon. And the tree of life maps on to this primordial man. And from the position of Keter, he shoots forth the divine light from his eyes into the first bucket. And he continues shooting it forth so it overruns the bucket and pours into the next bucket and the next bucket and the next bucket. And so each bucket contains the potential for all of the buckets after it, and each bucket contains the influence of all of the buckets before it. So, when you get down to the sphere of Din, or evil, all of the buckets after Din now don't have the potential for Din, but have the realized seed of evil, or the realized influence of evil within them. And so they are imperfect and cannot contain the light of God anymore. And so Din and all of the subsequent spheres all shatter and fall off of the tree, taking with them pieces of light. And they create the Klipot, or the hells beneath the tree, that have trapped in bits of the divine essence and therefore make the world imperfect, because God is now splintered off into the Klipot. Now, the idea of reparation that comes from the Klipoth is not really part of what we're dealing with at this point yet, but the idea of the necessity of a vessel that can contain the spiritual force is. God then repairs the situation by creating a new series of vessels to pick up where Din and the other vessels broke, and instead of replacing it with a new Din, he replaces it with Gevura, which is strength and sternness and judgment. And so the kind of God as the fierce ruling judge, or the emperor, replaces the evil. And so you still have a certain negative spin to what's going on there, but it's one that's based on God coming in and controlling the situation rather than the chaos related to Din. And so all of the new spheres have that strength within them that allows the vessels to be more perfect than the original set of vessels so they can hold the light. And that's the same idea that you're dealing with in the Man of Earth degree. If you were to go in and just say, okay, I'm going to wake up one day and decide I want to achieve knowledge and conversation with my holy guardian angel, and I'm going to take the next 6 months and go on this retreat where I'm just praying and meditating and fasting and doing all this stuff in order to gain these crazy visions where I understand myself and God and the universe and everything, you're going to be crazy at the end. Like, because you're not ready for it. You're going to break. And you're not going to have the discipline in order to follow it through to the end. You're not going to have the discipline in order to do it correctly. And you're not going to have the background in order to integrate what it is that you're gaining from the experience in the end. The experience will be just so vivid and powerful that hitting you without having the ability to direct it will just make you kind of go off into la-la land. One of the things that I've observed around like the OTO with a lot of the people who kind of come in and drift off, and they're like, oh, well, I've done these initiations, and now I've got all this, like, I have this like special thelemic magic energy and all, and I'm cool, and yeah, and they kind of go off and end up doing nothing. It's because they're opening up forces within themselves through doing the initiatic work, but they're not doing the other work surrounding it in order to build themselves up and have a way of directing where the forces go. It's like you're taking a pitcher of water and you're pouring out the pitcher of water into, like, nothing, where there's no vessel to direct how it's going. You don't have a funnel. You just have, like, a bag made of cotton balls. So, like, it holds up a little bit of water until it dissolves and falls apart and the water goes everywhere. And so that's kind of why it's necessary to undergo this Man of Earth degree, where you are, or this magician degree, where you're taking in all of the different elements and learning how to balance and control them, and therefore balance and control the elements of yourself. If you look at the magician card of the tarot, you've got the magician in front of an altar, and he's got the weapons that represent the elements, and he has infinity as his crown. Because the point of the magician is that he understands all of these forces, and he's able to control them in a balanced manner in order to pass the influence of infinity, or the influence of his soul, into the world in a controlled and directed fashion.
So, like in the OTO system, once we go through all the first 4 degrees and the, I guess what, the PI degree, we would have accomplished all of the balancing of the elements.
Not necessarily.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Yes. Yes, that's the goal.
Well,
yes, and they're one of the, and some people have disagreed with this, but one of the ninth degrees once told me that if you're going to achieve knowledge and conversation from the OTO system, then it would come with the Knight of the East and West degree, which is, yeah, the next one after fourth PI, so in between the Man of Earth and the Lovers. I thought somebody said "hmm" there, like they had a question about it.
I didn't say a word.
But so then that's on to the next degree then. The next degree in your 3-degree system is the Lovers, which for some reason people associate that one like strictly with the OTO. Mm-hmm. But probably because the AA system doesn't use those titles, and no one cares about the Order of Thelemites because it barely exists. In that phase of the work, you're dealing with Hadit. And so you're dealing with the individual soul torn off from the rest of the cosmos so that it can move about through the rest of the cosmos as life and vivification and individuation and experience. If you look at chapter 1 of the Book of the Law where Nuit speaks, a lot of it talks about stuff that very much is related to being and simply the sense of, like, I'm here and the types of experiences that we talk about here are just the experiences of being. They're not stuff where it's really doing. When you get to Hadit, it's like run around like crazy and do shit. And so you're experiencing the world through action and through movement and through individuality. And that the whole idea is that you're augmenting that movement and that individuality to the utmost at that point. The idea of here with the Lovers is that you are experiencing the marriage of heaven and earth, which often is treated as the absolute height of magic, initiation, and alchemy. If you look at some of the early Rosicrucian texts, this idea of the divine marriage is treated as if it is the central piece of all alchemical work and all spiritual work. In old Jewish Kabbalah, there was the belief that you could not achieve any initiation or real awareness of anything beyond the sphere of Tiferet, which relates to the divine marriage and that kind of balance. You could kind of know Gevurah and Hesed, which sit above it, but you could never actually enter into them. Within the GD and the AA structures, the kind of Lover's phase is the explicitly Rosicrucian phase. Where you have the RR at AC and the Golden Dawn, or the Ruby Rose and Cross of Gold, and in the AA, it's where you have the order of the RC. And this plays out in the mysteries and kind of responsibilities that you have in those phases. You're dealing more with a lot of the symbolism related to like the mysteries of the cross and a lot of the mysteries that are tied up with in Christianity. In the OTO system, there's much less express Rosicrucian element, but part of that triad is in the Rose Qua bodies, and they deal with the idea of balancing things as part of like their responsibility, which also relates to the sphere of Tiferet, that you are the sun, so you're balancing all the forces that are around you. And of course, this is also where you enter into Tiferet. And so therefore, since Tiferet is the sphere of the sun and is the sixth sphere on the Tree of Life, its symbol is the hexagram. And so in the Book of Lies, where Crowley talks about the holy hexagram, and people ask about this in learning the Star Sapphire, is what hexagram it is that you're supposed to be doing. The Star Sapphire expressly says the holy hexagram. Crowley expressly describes the holy hexagram in the Book of Lies. So there, it doesn't leave a lot of room for debate. The universal hexagram he talks about separately. But the holy hexagram is the straight-up Star of David. You have the upward triangle and the downward triangle overlapping each other, so the hexagram of Earth. But it goes a step further. Christine, behind you on the bookshelf next to the red hardback book is the Golden Dawn. Yes. If you look at the cover, if you sort of hold it up, everybody can look at it. You have an upward pointing blue triangle and a downward pointing red triangle, which is what Crowley describes the holy hexagram as. In that symbol, you have the upward triangle, which is fire, but it is colored with the color of Hesed, which is water. You have the downward triangle, which is water, and is colored with the color of Gevura, which is fire. So you have the balance of the two primary elements. In both alchemy and the Kabbalah, fire and water are the only actual real elements. Air is derived from fire and water, and earth is the combination of air, fire, and water. So, yeah, it can go back. Thank you. So you have a symbol which has a kind of fourfold representation of two elements, and it does so by marrying two of them together, by intersecting them, and then switching their attributes so that fire takes on the nature of water and water takes on the nature of fire, and through sharing their natures, they're able to combine with each other into one unit. So essentially you have kind of this yin and yang concept. But it goes a step further because in combining those oppositions and balancing them in that way, you reveal the sun. And the sun is what's at the center of the hexagram. When you use the seven classical planets, you have six of them ringing the outside of the hexagram, with the sun in the center directing and balancing the rest of the planets. And the reason that the sun is able to appear there at the center of the hexagram is because you've balanced the elemental forces through this symbol. And you've combined the aspiration towards the heavens with the descent of grace, essentially. So the upward pointing hexagram is the desire of the aspirant to raise up to the heavens. And he does that. The aspiration is, in one sense, the mercy of water, but the drive and motion of fire. And then grace descends down with the downward pointing triangle, and so it has the mercy of water granting the life of fire at that point to the aspirant. So both the aspirant and what he aspires to are the combination of fire and water, but it's only when they come together that you're able to see that, and in seeing that, the glory and light of the sun and the soul is revealed. So it's essentially the same symbol as the rose cross symbol. That in balancing the elements, you're then able to reveal the soul. And so again, you're dealing with the process that the Rosicrucian system goes through. And in this particular sense, instead of dealing with the cross, where you're dealing with the process, you're dealing with the result of the process. Because in this phase, you're no longer trying to perfect the material, you're receiving the perfected soul and allowing the soul to reconstitute the material that you've essentially destroyed. When we did the ritual earlier, we burned up the things that were not you, the things that you were destroying. When you burn something to an ash, to the point of having kind of a white-gray ash, you purify it down to some of the base salts that are within the material. And that process is called calcination. It's one of the first processes in alchemy, where you destroy everything that is not part of the pure physical structure of the item in an alchemical sense. Which is then why the ash and the oil are placed together on your forehead. Because the oil represents the soul, and the ash represents the purified remainder of yourself being reconstituted within you through the application of the solar force of the oil. In the Man of Earth triad, you're dealing with the burning of the material. In the Lovers, you're dealing with the application of the oil. You are essentially taking the soul and pouring it into the ash so it's reconstituted into a new phase. And that happens again in a different way in the Hermit's Triad, but we're not going to really talk about that. Along with those core elements of it, some of the symbolic elements, Lover's Triad, it's largely planetary in nature because you are the sun at that point. And so you recognize in dealing with Nuit and the Man of Earth and the elements, you recognize the forces of nature and catalog them and understand them so that you can use them as the magician. In coming into not simply making yourself a perfect vessel, but in actually being that vessel and actualizing yourself as your soul, now you're resolving and revolving the forces around yourself and recognizing not simply how the forces work in the universe, but how you can balance and control the forces based on the authority of your being and the gravity that you create by being this solar principle. It's also a phase in which sex magic has a particular almost necessity where it's tied up within that symbolism, in the symbolism of uniting opposite things to the point where you haven't quite transcended the opposition, but you've interlocked them so that you can understand the reality of their commingling, kind of like taking the copper and the iron and placing them together. You're taking Mars and Venus and allowing them to have their affair so that Hephaestus can tie them together into one substance at that point. It's also where you achieve the vision of the Rose Cross, which, again, not to explain the vision itself, but relates to the idea of the process of the soul moving through the material and recreating and reconstituting the material. And the vision of the Rose Cross becomes the inspiration for moving forward with the Abramelin working and taking that on, where you actually seek bringing the soul into yourself. Your soul's already in you. It's already there. But revealing the soul so that you are striving towards a point where there's nothing left, where the daily person that walks around in the world that everyone thinks of when they say your name, and the higher influences of your soul where you are expressing the particular piece of the universe and the particular piece of God that you are, cease to be two separate things, where they become one entity, where they are the same will. There's no differentiation between the higher will and the lower will in an ideal sense at that point. Now, maintaining that is almost impossible. You will still have points where there is a difference between what you want to do and what you're called to do. But as you move into that phase, you're moving closer and closer to where you close the gap between the two. And it's also the phase in which you begin to do much more real magic, where as a magician working the work of the Minerverse, you learn all the different parts of magic, and you're able to put them together, and you can use some of those parts to go do some magical things. Once you move past that phase and have mastered all of those parts, you're able to put them together where you can cleanly do the actual complete magical workings and deal with the forces of the universe almost on their terms, where they're coming into play, and because you are representing God in front of them, they kind of have to do what you tell them to do. And that kind of wraps up that particular degree. Now, the final degree, the Hermit, goes beyond what the purpose of this intensive is, so we're not going to focus on it too much, but relates to Rahur Kwit, or the idea of the child, the combination of the mother and the father. So instead of being the cosmos or being the soul, it's the idea of the cosmos and the soul in union to the point where there's no separation between the two. It's the consolidation of light into radiance. So radiance is light being effusive and spreading out all over the place. But in this case, radiance occurs because the light is drawn together as a single point, which is able to then radiate, but loses no element of its substance through the nature of its radiation, which really is the unique and weird element of light. In that, I was just going to flush that. But someone was in the bathroom and I took it back to do so. Huh?
You have your hands just like this, and it's like, it looks like DJ's holding a frog or something.
It's a magic frog. The peculiarity of light is that you have this particle that operates as a wave, and so it holds a point, but that point is existing throughout all these other points at the same time, and so anything else that you're dealing with, you're seeing it because light's bouncing off of it, but the light you're seeing because it's light and it's magic and weird. And that's what you're becoming in that phase when you enter into the Hermit's Triad, is you draw all of your light or all of your soul together, but unite it with the rest of the universe, so you essentially sublimate your being. Now, a lot of people talk about the necessity of killing the ego, or destroying the idea of I, or the idea of self as an individual, and giving yourself up to the greater good of the cosmos and the universe and God and all of that. And that's all bullshit. basically, it's a misunderstanding of the idea that when you perfect yourself and understand yourself so completely that you are able to move beyond the illusion of yourself, you recognize that there's no actual difference between yourself and the universe and God, but that does not mean that you're not an individual anymore. It means that you're able to simultaneously be an individual and be everything else. And because at that point, you're kind of mitigating all opposition. And so it's not balancing the opposition like it is when you're an adept. It's saying there is no more opposition. These two things which seem like they're at one end of the spectrum and the other end of the spectrum, this process of creating and destroying in order to do one or the other, they cease to be separate processes because you realize that not only are they just different ends of the same line, but that line is really all a single point. And the two happen simultaneously as one thing, and there's no difference between doing one or the other. You have to destroy in order to create, because destruction is creation. They are the same exact thing. It's not that one allows the other or one necessitates the other. It's that there is no other at that point.
It's like Shiva.
Yes.
Creation and destruction.
Mm-hmm. And or almost to the point of taking Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva and going back to the original Brahma, where they're all one.
Mm.
And at this phase of work, you kind of transcend magic in the sense of, I'm going to do this ritual and call this angel and tell the angel to go do this thing for me, because you've already integrated all of the angelic and demonic forces and all of the knowledge that you've explored through them into yourself. And so you're able to just kind of go ahead and deal with the actual forces of the universe directly. Whereas you're dealing with the planets and the elements in the earlier phases, at this point you're dealing with the zodiac, which represents kind of the origin of force before the force becomes completely differentiated. you are entering into the supernal phase of the Tree of Life, where you're dealing with concepts of potentiality and balance and eternity, and the sense that everything that could possibly ever be exists in the same moment as the same unity, but you're able to identify each individual possibility without actually separating them out from one another. And that's essentially the result of crossing the abyss and losing the separation between man and God. And so once you've done that, you're awesome. In another class recently, Mo asked me about what the characteristics of an actual master are. And to me, the most wonderful characteristic of that level of mastery is that you basically are a living philosopher's stone at that point. Now, you can't touch lead and the lead becomes gold. Yes, but you're a philosopher's stone in the human kingdom. Although I think, have I ever told any of you about my theory about outside of like having the stone for the plant kingdom, the animal kingdom, and the mineral kingdom, that you could have a separate human kingdom and create a stone for that, and that would probably be the philosopher's stone, because Paracelsus very clearly says that the philosopher's stone is not the stone of any of the three kingdoms, but most of your Renaissance alchemical work describes the philosopher's stone as the mineral kingdom. It's like my favorite like alchemical project that I want to someday do, where instead of transmuting dung like you usually do in the animal kingdom, or eggs, which is another thing that's common in animal alchemy, that you would take blood, urine, and semen and create a stone from those, because blood, when refined properly, creates an animal sulfur. Semen is sugar-based, and so you can create ethanol from it, which is alchemical mercury. And so, Junius Manfred, or Manfred Junius, who wrote Practical Plant Alchemy, actually talks about the high level of mercury within semen. And then the highest salt in alchemical work is sal ammoniac, or ammonia salt. And while usually people talk about deriving uric salt from urine, you can also actually derive sal ammoniac from urine. So you can take your highest salt from urine, you can take mercury from semen because it's like super mercury rich, and you can take sulfur from blood. So you have all three of your alchemical components, but they're stemming from people, and you have the generative aspect, which is necessary for the nature of the stone. Basil Valentinius talks about how the stone comes from two principles that, when brought together, are able to generate and create life. And all the things that you would use to create the mineral stone don't do that. But if you were to use menstrual blood and semen as your sources of sulfur and mercury, then you have an opposition in that you're taking the sulfur, which is the masculine principle, from a feminine substance, the mercury, which is the feminine principle, from a masculine substance, and they're substances which, in a natural state, put together, create life. And it's
not exactly.
Well,
yeah.
The menstrual blood is the dead life,
right.
But what the menstrual blood comes from. You can conceive during menstruation, though.
You can. You absolutely can.
Yes. The. Yeah.
It's rare
yeah.
Than
yeah.
It's not that rare.
Yeah. It's more the idea that the egg that you would conceive from is in the menstrual blood at that point, is where I'm going with it. So it fits together with the descriptions of the stone a lot better than the mineral stone does. And one day when I have a lab, I'm going to collect enough of all of those components and try it and see if it makes the phosphorus.
At Johns Hopkins, he's an alchemist.
Yeah. I should call him up and ask him. Like, I asked John Reed about it once, and he was like, that's not the animal stone. Why would you try to make that? Like, it's like, because it's better than the animal stone. Anyway, that's very on the outside of what we're discussing. So.
I can't wait to get this recording.
Yes. it's like my favorite alchemical idea ever. So you've got the three degrees, and those 3 degrees are, again, like we said, broken down into 10 grades. Now, we're not going to discuss the final three, because they're irrelevant for the whole idea of the sacred magic of Abramelin. They're what happens after you finish all your adept stuff. And really, when you get into those three, they all become one anyway, except where you have to die for the last one. So we don't need to talk about that. The first 7 grades. Okay, I don't know what that note is about. Basically, the initial 4 are taking you through the elemental worlds. So in the Kabbalah, you have this concept where, in addition to the Tree of Life, being a way in which you break down all the manifestations of the divine into the universe, that the Tree of Life can be understood through these different elemental levels or the elemental worlds. And the process of manifestation transmits itself through these elemental worlds as well. And your first 4 grades move you through the perception of the elemental worlds and take you essentially backwards through them. So that you're starting out in Asiya, or Earth, the most manifest and physical level, and you're moving up through them into Atzilut, or Fire, where you are in the most conceptual spiritual level of all of them. So you are uncreating yourself in order to perfect your being so that you can become the vessel for your soul. Yes. And some organizations refer to the entire phase of this triad or this degree as the black work, because it's the alchemical phase in which you undergo calcination, which, since calcination is when you burn something down to ash, can probably give you an idea of how much fun you undergo when you do this work properly. Basically, what you're doing as you go through these elemental worlds is you're obviously not going door to door and saying, okay, today I'm in Asiya, okay, well, here Yetzirah is next door, I can walk into this house and I'm in Yetzirah. You are dealing with changing your perception, your perspective, and your being. Kind of an interesting, the same guy that told me that KEW is where you want to look for knowledge and conversation in the OTO system, pointed out to me that the difference between the kind of degree structure that we use in the OTO and the grade structure used in the AA is that in the AA, you're actually changing your nature and your being and what you are as you move through the grades. In the OTO, you're understanding different states of being, but the states of being are more like rooms that you can move through. And so you can say, okay, well, in order to deal with this, I need to operate the way I would operate in this room. In order to deal with that, I would need to operate the way I'm operating in that room. And you can kind of move through them, and then once you go through all of them and understand all of them, you can kind of inhabit your life in whatever way is suited to you and to being successful within your life based on the lessons of that particular degree. And I can kind of see that to some level with the ones that I've gone through, but there's also an element where they do kind of seem to fold together and expand upon each other, and it's like, well, you can apply all of the different things at once too, but there are definitely some situations where it's like, okay, this lesson applies more, that lesson applies more. With the AA structure, as you're moving through changing your perspective and your perception on things, it's like anything else that you learn or experience. Once you change your perception and the way in which you view the world, you can change it again later and develop it more, but you're still going to be influenced and informed by the previous changes you've undergone. And so as you move from understanding the world in a physical manifest form to understanding it in an intellectual form, and you fully integrate that intellectual understanding, you're still going to be able to understand the earth in its physical manifest form while understanding this intellectual understanding at the same time. And the two are going to kind of work together, but the physical manifest form is going to be understood through the lens of the intellectual form. And then as you move into the more conceptual levels, you're going to understand the intellectual and physical through the emotional and through the associative, and then understand those all through the purely conceptual active elements of the world of Atzilut. And before we go further. Bye, Karen. Yes, thank you for cooking for us.
You're welcome. And just, I left that out in case you wanted to nibble on it. Just please, a couple folks assist with taking care of wrapping that up.
Yeah, we should have done one for
it. Make sure that when you dump the coffee, you get the crumbs.
Mm-hmm.
All right, bye.
Will
you be here tomorrow?
I will.
Yay.
You and Richard have fun. Have too much fun.
Have lots of fun. I
want to
hear it from
here. Take it, he's been out of town for a bit.
No, it's their anniversary tomorrow.
Oh.
So. One of the questions that comes up between different ways of working the system is, do you actually inhabit these spheres that you're going through with the initiation? When I was in the Order of the Celestial Academy, the people there were mostly coming from contemporary Golden Dawn systems. And there's a very clear, like, fixation on the idea that you never leave Malkuth, that you are always in Malkuth and you're always understanding the concepts of these other spheres, but you're never actually engaging them or entering into them or actually initiating into them. That you might be able to kind of get into Yesod a little bit because you're always in the physical kingdom and you can kind of deal with your mind, which is what's dealt with in those two spheres, but there's no way you could ever actually raise your awareness to something higher than that. That's just for the birds. You don't inhabit the spheres in the sense of, well, once you finish your initiation to Earth, you're going to flit off into this completely arid intellectual world that you're now walking around in. You inhabit them in the sense that you are immersed in forces that relate to that particular sphere, and your awareness is based on that immersion of those forces, and that changes you in a way in which you begin to see and understand the world from that perspective. And so you do inhabit the sphere of Asiyah, you inhabit the sphere of Yetzirah and Briah and Atzilut, or of earth, air, water, and fire, but you're still inhabiting your physical space. It's just the place in which your mind and soul are operating in terms of how you're going to understand the things around you. And as you go through this, like I said, you're going to integrate all of these perspectives. Each world contains the seed of the next. So when creation begins in Atzilut and you have the initial stirrings of movement and things coming down to be created, it has the potential in it for all of the concepts that will exist in the world of water, all the thoughts and ideas that will exist in the world of air, and the actual physical being that will exist in the world of earth. So as you move back up from earth into fire, you're still going to have those things that you take with you from the others, because they're all going to be integrated in. Now, these elemental worlds are represented through the elemental weapons, which, depending on the way in which you're working the grade structure, become kind of hallmarks or icons for working that grade. The weapons themselves symbolize the universe as seen through the lens of that world. So you have the disc or pentacle for earth, the dagger for air, the cup for water, and the wand or scepter for fire. When you are making the weapons, a lot of people get very fixed on, like, well, what's the weapon supposed to look like? Or what material am I supposed to make it out of? Or what do I do with the physical weapon once I have it? The making of the physical weapon is actually almost a side project. The point of making the weapon is to undergo the process so that you understand how to make the weapon. And the weapon itself is a symbol of the fact that you have integrated the understanding of the universe through that elemental mentality within your soul and your being. So you are the pentacle, the dagger, the cup, and the wand. You can use the external physical forms of them to aid yourself in the symbol language that you're using for your magical rituals, but the actual natures, powers, and expressions that are represented by those symbols have to be ingrained within your being in order for them to have any real efficacy or real power. Because you ultimately are the actual magical tool that is being created. And this gets into where the magician is the cosmos, the whole macrocosm, microcosm idea. That since your being is an echo or a mirror of the greater universe, sort of like the idea of the atom as like a mini solar system, that on each layer of creation you have a almost fractal piece that's being built together in order to create a larger image of the same thing, all interacting together. That these tools are representations of the cosmos, just understood in different ways. And you are the cosmos, and you're gaining the understanding of that given nature. So if you really gain that understanding, the same symbol that you're imprinting on your tool should be the way that your soul is looking in that given moment, or the way in which you are reflecting the universe through yourself in that given moment. The process of creating these also relates to the actual process of alchemical refinement. The tools are created through the work that you do. So not just the work of, I'm going to take a piece of clay and I'm going to mold the clay into a disc and I'm going to carve some shit into the disc, but the work of going through all of the meditations, the yoga, the rituals, all of the things that you're doing in order to bring yourself more in line with that understanding and immerse yourself within the magical forces or the occult or universal forces that relate to that given understanding of the universe. And it's the work that actually imprints the world within you. So people will ask me sometimes, like, okay, I'm trying to do the earth work, I'm trying to build my pentacle, what should I be doing? Like, should I start carving the pentacle? Should I start reading 777 and arranging the forces from 777 into my pentacle image? Or should I pick like some magical symbol that I like and make that my pentacle? It's like, no, you should go meditate, and you should invoke the spirit of earth, and you should deal with the platonic solid of earth, and deal with all of these other things that are going to create earth manifestations and an understanding of the sphere of Asiya. And then you should go out and physically do things that are going to make you experience what it is to know the world through physicality, what it is to touch things and understand that the actual physical form of something that you're touching and interacting with is different from the intellectual definition that you have of the thing. That they're the same in the sense that they're the same thing, but the way in which you understand a thing through touching it is very different. In fact, how many people do we have? Now that Basil is asleep, we have 10. So partner up with somebody, and you two, I guess, can partner. Each of you tell the other person something about yourself, some way in which you would define yourself. Then, once you've each done that,
just touch each other's faces and heads.
And
how old are you people now?
17. It's his head, it's not
that. You're old enough, it wouldn't be that. 28.
Yes, as well.
I usually get about your age when I ask people how old I am. Something about you. Something that identifies you as I'm thinking myself. Tourist soprano, which means I can split your nose. All right. Yeah. Yeah.
I have tried a lot.
gymnasium and stuff, and like all of them, I've never seemed to stick with cycling long enough. Couple of years before I skateboarded.
You haven't found the right activity yet.
Yeah.
So, because I guess they're still doing the feeling part.
I already saw how James is framed up.
So we could think of this as like the flatland exercise. Yes. Where in flatland there's only one dimension and they kind of just move around and they have to like figure out who it is they're dealing with by like butting up against each other. And so everything is observed in a purely yes. The yeah, that's right. It's one dimensional wouldn't exist. But so the like imagine if you had a whole world where everything that you knew you experienced in that manner, where you were just experiencing it through touching. And yeah, I mean, even when we experience things through interacting with, through speech and ideas and everything like that, it's still the concussive force of the sound that you're experiencing. Mm-hmm. But what you're experiencing in terms of the thoughts that you have are still completely tied up in the physical sensations that you've had about the thing. Now, you have some places where you kind of move a little bit into the intellectual elements of things based on what you know about a thing, but a lot of your response to those intellectual things are still going to be based on your kind of physical gut responses to things and the physical associations that you have with that thing. Because your natural state is a state of being in Asiya, or being in the world, and dealing with things in a physical sense. Initiation allows you to move beyond that into the intellectual and the emotional and then sort of a pure sense of knowing things. So you want to switch seats back?
No.
That's really cute. I can understand you wanting to continue sitting next to him, but I want to be where my microphone can hear me. So he reminds me of Veer. He has like the same kind of eyes and facial structure as Veer. And there are things that he's talked about that are like things that like Veer has said. it's creepy. They're like the two elf people. But
I don't know who Veer is.
He's the international treasurer for the OTO. But where are we here? Okay. The process of going through the elemental initiations is also one of kind of the alchemy of imbalance, which almost seems contradictory. Alchemy, you would think it's like, okay, it's about balancing and perfecting things and making them all right. It's like, well, here you're undergoing alchemy where you undergo it by imbalancing yourself, which is where you get into the calcination element of it and why it becomes hell. You're creating that cross of gold that we talked about earlier. And you create the cross by taking the gross material and turning it into this gold cross of the elements. So you're taking yourself and everything that you are and experience, all the ways that you relate to the world, and you're stripping down your basic innate gut view of how you're going to relate to everything. And you're refining it by understanding how the world works on all these multiple levels and how you're going to interact with it on these multiple levels and kind of the way things are supposed to be based on these higher levels of creation and how a thing is supposed to be based on how it works on each level of creation. And coming to know how to interact with it in that fashion. And in doing so, you can't just wake up in the morning and say, like, okay, I'm going to integrate all of the elements and all the elemental perspectives of into my being today all at once. You kind of have to do them one at a time, and it takes a while for each one in some cases. Earth is the easiest, though, because you're already there. But really?
Me too.
Like, I don't know. It took me about maybe 3 months to do my Earth grade. Like the other ones took like forever. But you're kind of dealing with going through and one element at a time, integrating that element into your sphere by moving yourself into a complete immersion into that elemental sphere. So when you start out in kind of an earthy place anyway, where you kind of know things from a physical sense, but you are moving into, but you also know, have a little bit of an intellectual sense, a little bit of an emotional sense of things. All of a sudden you're kind of like, okay, I'm rocketing myself deeply into this like earthy way of knowing things. Now, I'm not saying you're necessarily going to walk up and just start like touching people on the face to recognize who it is, but you're going to start conceptualizing and thinking of the world in terms of physical experiences and physical interactions and the way in which physical things represent other things to yourself. So you'll start looking at like, okay, well, I go to this one place all the time, and I go there because I have to do these things at the place. I go to the grocery store because I have to buy groceries. But there are other things that the grocery store as a physical location represents to me, and the ways in which the grocery store is a manifestation of these other higher physical forces. So even these other things that you aren't necessarily typically thinking of trying to know by common day-to-day physical things, you're going to begin to start to explore them through those things and understand how that not only increases your understanding of how the grocery store works, but also increases your understanding of how that concept works and how everything else related to that concept works. Yes?
I know, for example, music is related to
Color. Color is related to the emotional level. So color is in Bria along with shapes. Musical notes are in Bria. Written music is in both, sort of. But the you have the actual intellectual process of the music in air, but you have the emotional response to the music in water.
I have a question. The very bottom, okay, and then the next one is Mensurah. And then right over to that one. Number 7 is...
Seven is Netzach, and 8 is Hod. If you're talking about
Hod.
The spheres. Yeah.
Hod, okay. Hod and Netzach. Okay.
Netzach.
Yes.
Netzach. Hod. Yes. Yetzirah is the other elemental world. So
from Malkuth, we saw Hod and Netzach. That are we in Asia?
Asiya is this the worlds comprise the entire tree. There's sometimes where you'll do a division where you say this section of the tree is in this world, this section is in this world, this section is in the other world. But typically what you'll see is where you have essentially four trees of life.
Okay.
And so the trees stack into one another through the elemental worlds. So the Keter of Asiya is the Malchut of Yetzirah.
Right.
The Keter of Yetzirah is the Malchut, Bria, and so forth. And so it all follows down. So almost like you have 40 spheres instead of 10. So you're moving through and you're imbalancing yourself and these different elements by creating a complete immersion. And by doing that, you come to a full understanding of what that elemental modality is. But until you create that understanding, it can be fairly problematic. Like when you're working with air, if you start intellectualizing everything that you're dealing with because you're having an imbalance towards the direction of air, that's going to be problematic when you go to deal with things that are emotional. And you start trying to intellectually and logically handle all of your emotions and all of your emotional and relationship interactions with people. In immersing yourself in these forces are going to create changes and impacts on your life aside from just the perceptions that you're dealing with. So relationships that you have in your life, things that are part of how your life is structured will change as a result of this. And in order to make them flow correctly, you have to understand the nature of the change based on understanding the nature of that elemental world and adjust both yourself and the situation in order to more completely kind of accentuate and actualize that elemental force. And so what you're doing in integrating the element is trying to kind of create a mastery of that worldview, where you can say, okay, I'm dealing with these issues of separation because I'm dealing with air, but through applying logic to understanding that separation and applying the intellect to understanding that situation, separation, I can mitigate the separation in a way that's harmonious and understand how that separation creates a new other type of connectivity. And once you're able to do that smoothly, that's where you've actually come to inhabit that elemental world almost as a native of that elemental world. That perception or that perspective is now your perspective, and you are able to move into the next element. You're still imbalanced, but you have kind of a harmonized imbalance at that point. And the basically you've created a place where you are now like an incomplete manifestation. You're manifesting on this given level of being or level of creation, but you need to move through the rest of them in order to fully complete yourself, which is where Crowley kind of starts once you get past Yasod, where you're into the more intense elements that are off the center of the Tree of Life. He's like, okay, at this point, you can't leave the AA system until you've finished the elemental work, because you're going to be too imbalanced and too fucked up. So the way in which you fix that imbalance is the way in which the elements interlock with each other, like we saw in the hexagram. You have the interlocking of fire and water. Earth and air are lower octaves or lower echoes of that fire and water, and so you still have another masculine and feminine potential that interlock together. So you have the dagger writes upon the disc, and the wand inserts into the chalice. So you have a balancing between the kind of sexual in terms of the gender natures of the elements, and the way in which the elements function as expansive and contracting forces. When you put them together, you have this kind of balanced creation, whereas any of them individually, you would have kind of just things falling apart or being destroyed because they would expand completely or they would contract completely. And so the kind of initial mystery of going through the elements is obtaining this balance. But it also reflects sort of the nature of adepthood in that sense, as the adept through Tiferet balances different forces. So you're obtaining where you're going by mimicking the nature of where it is that you're going to get in that way. And it also hides the mystery of dissolution. You are balancing things so that they can interact with each other in a harmonious way. The harmony that results from that is essentially the dissolution of the opposition, but you can't see the dissolution yet. You only experience the harmony. And so that's where you have this concept of, by obtaining the golden cross, the rose is able to blossom forth. The rose representing then the kind of harmony of the soul, or the kind of perfection that you're able to achieve by having the forces all vibrating together in a harmonious manner instead of one in which they're distinct and dissonant. Do we need to take a quick break before I go into the individual grades and the mysteries related to those, or do you guys want to...
4 minutes.
4 minutes?
Okay. Four, just starting. I'll be back.
Were there any questions about any of that so far? I know that was kind of a lot all at once.